WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Now that the meeting between James Baker and Tariq Aziz has ended in failure, the French are pursuing a diplomatic solution that would call for an international peace conference on the Middle East after Iraq's withdrawal from Kuwait. The conference would address Israel and the Palestinians. The U.S. opposes this linkage. But peace in the Middle East requires addressing the Palestinians, according to Rashid Khalidi, Associate Director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Chicago. Khalidi has written extensively on modern Arab history and the rise of Palestinian nationalism. At a press conference after the Aziz-Baker meeting, the Iraqi foreign minister didn't discuss Kuwait, but he did discuss the necessity of resolving the Palestinian question. I asked Khalidi if he thought Iraq was being opportunistic in dwelling on the Palestinians, and wouldn't linkage reward Iraq's aggression?
Well, very clearly both sides are posturing in public in a way that plays to their selected audiences. The Iraqis are trying to make it appear that they're doing everything they're doing for the sacred cause of Palestine. It takes a really wild stretch of the imagination to believe that, and I don't think most people in the Arab world do, but what the Iraqis are trying to do is to say this is not simply a case of invasion, annexation, occupation, and so on and so forth. It is, in fact, linked to these causes that most people in the Arab world believe have some merit. Similarly, the United States is trying to deny that there is a connection between security issues relating to the Gulf and security issues relating to the Arab-Israeli conflict, trying to deny a variety of things that are probably true on the face of them, and trying to focus things as narrowly as possible on the issue of Kuwait. I think that where the issue of linkage comes up, the important point is if there should be a settlement in the Arab-Israeli conflict, this is a question that should be decided on its merits. And if everybody is so terribly concerned about not making it appear that there's a reward for aggression, then deal with these issues sequentially. I mean, there is within diplomatic parlance and within the imagination of mankind certainly sufficient devices so that it does not necessarily, there is no overt, obvious linkage, but such that it is possible for the world to address another glaring problem after or in sequence with dealing with the problem of Kuwait. People often say, how can we deal with the Arab-Israeli conflict? We must deal with the most recent aggression. What a lot of people in the Arab world say is, well, why deal with the one that's only with the one that's recent? What about the ones that have been around for a long time? And if this is something that's a problem for the United States, and I can see how it might be, you don't want overt linkage, very well. Say there's no linkage. We'll deal with Kuwait, and then very quietly say, and some others at some definite stage in the future, we're going to deal with this other thing. The reason that you should do this is that they are linked. I mean, you can't talk about Iraq's nuclear capacity or Iraq as a strategic threat without talking about Israel. In fact, that's the only thing most people who talk about it in this country have any interest in. I have to say, most people who worry about Iraq and the United States are not really terribly worried about Iran or Turkey. Many of them perhaps are worried about Saudi Arabia, but most of them are worried about Israel. Well, since there is an interrelation between Iraq and Israel, since Iraq is a part of the Arab-Israeli conflict one way or another, then very clearly, in real terms, there is some form of linkage.
You would like to see a Middle East peace conference specifically address the UN Security Council Resolution 242 from 1967?
And a number of other UN Security Council resolutions. There is a stack of UN Security Council resolutions on the Arab-Israeli conflict a lot higher than the stack relating to the Iraq of Kuwait. There are resolutions relating to Israel's annexation of Jerusalem, resolutions relating to the Golan Heights, resolutions relating to South Lebanon, passed by an international consensus, including the United States, the Soviet Union, and all the other permanent members, with exactly the same force in international law as the 12 resolutions that Secretary Baker talked about in his press conference, which have lain gathering dust since 1967 or 1969 or 1978 or whenever. I would like to see all of these resolutions taken as the basis for a serious effort to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict. I think it's gross hypocrisy and grotesque, and really something quite grotesque of the United States to launch the current effort on the basis of UN Security Council resolutions when the United States seems not to be lifting a finger to implement other resolutions that it voted for, in some cases it wrote, drafted, sponsored, and which have lain ignored and in some cases flouted by Israel or by other Middle East parties for decades in some cases.
Let's get to the resolution of 1967, Resolution 242. What did that say?
Well, it's always been boiled down to the formula of land for peace. That's the way it's traditionally been interpreted. It talks about an Israeli withdrawal from territories occupied in the 1967 conflict. Note the term the United Nations uses. It uses occupied. Contrary to the assertions of some people, as far as international law is concerned, Israel is in occupation of those territories. It then calls for a just peace. It calls for relations between the Arab countries and Israel. It calls for, in other words, a real normalization of relations between Israel and its neighbors, of the right of all states to live in peace within secure and recognized boundaries, and so on and so forth, as the sort of quid pro quo for this Israeli withdrawal from these territories that it occupied in 1967. That's the gist of 242.
I think a question about 242 is, how would a peace be enforced if Israel gave up the occupied territories? Israel lives in constant fear that neighboring Arab states wouldn't respect the statehood of Israel.
Well, remember that Arab states would have to sign a treaty with the state of Israel, would have to recognize the state of Israel, would have to do the kinds of things that Egypt has done, exchange ambassadors and open up aerial links and all that sort of thing. Moreover, in 1991, we have a whole lot of examples of how you normalize abnormal situations. The way in which the Cold War has finally wound down in Europe and the kind of agreements on reducing forces and guaranteeing security, which have finally been worked out between Europeans, Americans, and Soviets after many, many decades of wrangling, I think maybe provide an avenue or a clue as to what can be done in the Arab-Israeli case. It's not only, I would argue, that the various disputes have to be resolved and that there has to be peace and an end to occupation and so on and so forth. I think there also has to, very clearly has to be, movement towards control of weapons, movement towards control especially of strategic weapons in the region on a mutually agreed basis, and that's going to require a lot of haggling. But I think security has to be a part of a settlement and a security agreement such that the kinds of fears, which I have to point out not only Israel, but most of its neighbors have with good reason, are addressed. I mean, you're talking about a situation where Israel, because of Jewish history, is in fear of possible consequences of war, and because of Israel's own specific history, has had an experience of many wars. Similarly, the Arab world perceives Israel as a potentially dangerous to it, and nowadays Israelis are worrying about the possibility of bombardment of Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, Beirut, Damascus, Cairo, Amman, Tunis, and Baghdad have all been bombed by Israel. So both sides have lots of fears, and there are security concerns on both sides, and any settlement would have to do more than just rearrange boundaries. It would have to also address very, very explicitly these kinds of fears in the kinds of ways in which the Europeans have finally put to rest similar concerns that have plagued them since World War II.
Rashid Khalidi is my guest. He's Associate Director of the University of Chicago's Center of Middle Eastern Studies. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Rashid Khalidi is my guest. He's an Associate Professor of Middle Eastern History at the University of Chicago. I'm going to ask you really straightforwardly here. You're part Palestinian, and I'm wondering if, because of your own background, you are seeing the Iraq question is relating to the Palestinian question more than others might.
Well, I think that anybody who has read the flood of media and other output since the crisis began will have noticed the number of times, the hundreds and thousands of times, that the issue of Iraq is related to the issue of Israeli security. I don't think I or any Palestinian American invented that link. In other words, Israelis are concerned about Iraq. Iraqis are concerned about Israel. Israel bombed Iraq. Iraq threatened Israel. You know, one could go on and on and on. I don't believe that that's an invention of the Iraqis or the Israelis or me. Moreover, the United States chose to take this issue to the Security Council and chose to raise this into a sort of a sacred crusade on the basis of the sanctity of international law. It just happens that international law is indivisible and that Security Council resolutions are equally valid or should be equally valid, and that there is a whole avalanche of Security Council resolutions voted for by every American administration since the 60s relating to the Arab-Israeli conflict. So in those two, it's, at least as far as those two elements are concerned, linkage is something that is a fact of life, whether we like it or not, whether we accept it or not, whether we want to bury our heads in the sand or not.
You agree that Saddam Hussein didn't invade Kuwait with the ultimate goal of helping the Palestinians. What are his ulterior motives in trying in bringing the Palestinian question into the negotiations?
I would agree. I don't think that was the motivation for Iraq. Whatever the Iraqi government says, I don't think that is credible. I think that the motivations have to do with a variety of things. One was a serious miscalculation of the American response to an invasion of Kuwait. That miscalculation was based on a reading of the American position before August 2nd, which was perhaps understandable, but wrong. Secondly, there was very clearly a desire to punish Kuwait and a desire to obtain resources to extract Iraq from its crushing economic crisis. There are probably a number of other factors, and most of them, I would argue, have to do with Iraqi national security and Iraq's immediate foreign policy objectives rather than the Arab-Israeli conflict or the Palestine question.
But what does Saddam Hussein have to gain by trying to make a connection between the Palestinians and his invasion of Kuwait?
It's one of the few things that he can presume or pretend justifies the invasion of Kuwait. The invasion of Kuwait, on the face of it, is indefensible. It's indefensible in Arab terms, and it's indefensible in terms of international law. Nobody in the Arab world that I know of outside of Iraq recognizes the annexation of Kuwait, including countries that are supportive of Iraq in its confrontation with the United States. So the Iraqis have a very weak case in international law and before Arab public opinion to the extent to which it can be restricted to the single issue of Kuwait, to the extent to which they can muddy the waters. And to some extent they've succeeded in doing this by talking about their having done this for the sacred cause of Palestine and so on, to the extent to which they can point up what is unquestionably hypocrisy on the part of the United States in its refusal to budge on certain Arab-Israeli issues or to see to the implementation of Security Council resolutions that deal with Israel, while it shows alacrity in implementing Security Council resolutions that deal with Iraq. To the extent to which the Iraqis can do that, they are playing not a winning card, at least a viable card, in terms of Arab public opinion.
What effects do you think the conflict in the Gulf is having on Arab unity?
Well, the conflict in the Gulf has revealed the divisions in the Arab world. At the same time, I would warn people who are jumping up and down in glee at the prospect of the Arabs yet again divided and cannot restrain their pleasure at this prospect, that there's a very deep level at which, in the Arab world, at which there is unanimity. I would argue there are very few people in the Arab world who want war, and I would argue that there's the reluctance to contemplate a war, and the fear of its results is something that could well be the basis for a very strong, if not Arab unity, at least trend within the Arab world. And that this is the case in countries like Egypt and Syria and Morocco, which have troops in Saudi Arabia, just as it's the case in countries like Yemen and Jordan and Sudan and Libya and Algeria, which are much more skeptical about the American presence. So there is no Arab unity, and the Arab world is deeply divided. Certainly the Arab governments are deeply divided, and Arab public opinion shows a number of different outlooks and trends. But on a couple of issues, there's very, very strong consensus, and one of them is that a settlement should not be achieved by force, but should be achieved peacefully. And I don't think there'll be any support for a war when war comes.
Among Arabs?
In the Arab world, yeah.
Do you think that even Arab countries who are American allies wouldn't fight if there was actually a war? That they might break away?
They might have to, but I don't think there'll be any support for it, and I don't think that you're going to see a lot of officers and men fighting the Iraqi army with any enthusiasm on the part, particularly of the Egyptian and Syrian armies. These are armies that have considered the Iraqi army their ally over many wars. These are, in the case of the Egyptians, these are people who have helped Iraq against Iran in the Gulf War very recently. And the idea of helping the United States to smash an Arab army is not going to go down well in the officer corps of the Arab countries that are participating, even if their leaderships order them to participate. I don't think that pleasure, and I don't think it's going to play well in Damascus and Cairo.
Let me ask you, we're hearing about FBI attempts to find Arab Americans and to investigate whether they're part of any possible Iraqi-related terrorism. What do you know about that? And I wonder if you've been contacted at all or have friends or colleagues who have?
Many people in the Arab American community have been contacted. And I think that this really boils down to an unfounded assumption that Arab Americans could conceivably engage in such things. And because they have to know better, it really amounts to harassment. There's no reason that the agencies of the United States government do not know that this is simply unfounded and unjustifiable as an assumption. If they don't know it, then it's a disgrace. And whatever the intentions behind it, that certainly is the way it's being perceived in the Arab American community.
You know of people who've been contacted?
Yes, I do know of Arab Americans who've been contacted just in the last couple of days.
Let me ask you a question that you might see as kind of flip, but I'm just kind of curious about the answer. I don't know if you heard it or not, but recently on All Things Considered, Harry Shearer did a very funny sketch mm-hmm. about how President Bush is constantly mispronouncing Saddam Hussein's first name.
Mm-hmm. Calling I didn't hear it.
Oh, okay. Well, he keeps calling him Saddam. Mm-hmm. And so Shearer, you know, it was very funny about how this is just like another way to alienate and irritate the head of Iraq. How is his name pronounced? Do you know?
Saddam Hussein is the way his name is pronounced. Saddam Hussein.
Is anybody taking offense at George Bush's constant mispronunciation?
I don't know that anybody's taking offense at it. It's a sign of ignorance that after 5 months the president can't pronounce it correctly. It's a sign of I take it as a sign that nobody who knows enough Arabic to tell him that he's mispronouncing it is close enough to him to talk to him. I mean, it's pretty clear that this is a government operating without the benefit of any expertise on the Middle East, or they wouldn't have done many of the things they've done in the past 5 months. And every report I've read, whether in the New York Times or stuff I've heard on National Public Radio, indicates that the people closest to the president are innocent of any knowledge of or experience in the Arab world or the Middle East. We do not have a lot of expert advice up there, as far as I can tell. It shows from the results, but it's also been reported, and it's everybody I know says the same thing. People in the government and outside the government who are experts all seem not to have been consulted. And if that's the case, as I think it is, it's symptomatic, and it's symbolized by the fact the president can't pronounce the name of this person that he's been demonizing for the past 5.5 months.
Do you have any hope left for peace?
Not very much, unfortunately. I hope that it will still be possible to stop a war. I hope that the Iraqis will see reason and make whatever concessions are necessary. I hope the United States will see reason and show whatever flexibility is necessary. And I hope whatever mediators get involved can exercise some leverage in Washington and Baghdad. But I don't think that that's very likely, unfortunately.
Rashid Khalidi, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Rashid Khalidi is Associate Director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Chicago. This is Fresh Air.